Swine update. Last week, as you recall,
pigs in space!
We last saw the spaceship Swine Trek. Captain Link Hogthrob was suffering from a mysterious space disease.
The global pandemic fears over H1N1 seem a bit less like a crisis and more like a media circus this week. Doctors in space watching the numbers decline. What do we do now?
As you may recall, our last episode had nothing to do with the previous episode.
Looking for Sanjay Gupta, tracking the flu in week two. Masks and gloves are off on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Can't resist those Sanjay Gupta jokes. Good morning. It's Monday, May 4th. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm joined this morning by Farai Jadeah. Hey, Farai.
Oh, pigs in space. I love that one. Anyway, coming up this hour, Chrysler is going to be in cahoots with Italian automaker Fiat. We're going to check in with two auto industry veterans about how the transition might go. We'll also talk about the outbreak of H1N1 virus, also known as swine flu. It looks like it might be declining in Mexico. We're going to talk about what we can expect from the bank stress test. Results are coming out on Thursday. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon is accusing some countries of discriminating against Mexican travelers because of the outbreak of H1N1 or swine flu.
Parece injusto que a raíz de que hemos sido honestos y transparentes con el mundo haya algunos países o lugares.
President Calderon says the discrimination is unfair because Mexico was honest and transparent with the world. Comments are probably aimed at China, which has quarantined dozens of Mexican travelers, including many apparently not at risk. Farai?
Italian carmaker Fiat is in talks to buy parts of the European business of General Motors, including Vauxhall and Opel. Fiat's already planning to take major stakes in Chrysler. Auto analyst John McElroy says those are all bold moves.
Combining with Chrysler and Opel is just about going to triple Fiat's current size. But the real question is whether or not Fiat has the management bench strength.
Now, GM has been trying to find investors for its non-core assets to help stave off collapse. And meanwhile, negotiations over the fate of the Boston Globe newspaper have stopped just for the moment. They continued well past midnight, without agreement. The paper's owner, our partner, the New York Times Company, is threatening to close the Globe if unions don't agree to $20 million in cuts. Unions say that's a bullying tactic.
Asian markets were higher this morning. Japan's Nikkei was up nearly 2%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng up more than 5%. And you may have noticed that the name of my co-host, Adora Udoji, is missing from the show this morning. There's a good reason for that. As you've heard over the last several weeks, Adora recently adopted a new baby. She let us know last week that she's giving up the host chair here at The Takeaway to spend more time with her new daughter. We wish her all the best, of course. As we begin to look for someone to fill the chair here at The Takeaway, I'm going to be joined by Farai and others in the coming weeks. Finally, here in the U.S., the Dow opens today at 8212. In about an hour and a half, the S&P kicks off at 878. Futures point to a positive to flat opening. The economy has you scrimping and saving and giving up and giving in, but there are limits to thrift.
My name is Nola, and I'm calling from the Appalachia. And my garden. I'll spend money on my garden.
So, in honor of prom time here at The Takeaway, what don't you scrimp on? What is it you spend no matter what the economy is doing? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. So we don't exactly know how it's going to work, but the iconic American automaker Chrysler isn't really so American anymore. Last week, it filed for bankruptcy and started an arrangement with the Italian automaker Fiat, which begins with about a 20% stake and could end up being full ownership by Fiat. What does this mean? Well, at the very least, it means that Chrysler workers join a very large club here in the United States working for foreign auto companies. And joining us to give us some insight into that experience and maybe some advice for Chrysler workers who are wondering what their future is James Harbor, who's an automotive industry analyst and retired Ford and Chrysler employee. He joins us from Troy, Michigan. James, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
And Tim Garrett is a retired vice president of administration at Honda. He joins us from Marysville, Ohio, where there is a big Honda plant. Tim Garrett, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
First of all, James, what advice do you have for Chrysler workers who are suddenly looking at their paychecks maybe coming from somewhere overseas?
Well, that's not a problem right now. The problem right now is they got the next 60 days to sit down and do nothing because everything was shut down here last week or effective this morning. And so they're all wondering what plants are going to stay, what jobs are going to stay, and what are they going to be doing in the future.
Tim Garrett, certainly if you're a worker for a company where you're not in a union shop and your bosses essentially are, you know, way across the ocean, you're used to having your fate be decided and sitting on your heels while things get decided. Is that a difficult situation to be in, or should American workers just kind of get used to this because it's a new reality?
Well, the reality in our case was the fact that even though we were part of the global Honda network, most of the operating decisions that we made here in Ohio were made locally. Most of the decision out of Japan dealt with, for instance, global production scheduling. So day-to-day operations, policies, procedures, and all those were effectively managed and controlled locally. Now, so it's far more local than what you may realize.
What were the criteria, though, in terms of the profitability of the company? Did you have to meet performance targets at Honda?
We were very much performance-driven. Most of that performance-driven was taken on what we call operational characteristics, which were day-to-day operational requirements, cost requirements, quality requirements, et cetera. Then all that fed up into an overall global performance expectations. But because of being global in nature, all the different regions had their unique situations. And they were managed on a regional basis. We did not manage Honda on a global basis, but managed it very much on a regional basis.
Okay,
we had six different regions.
James, how hard is that to maintain a local sense of autonomy when so much of your fate is being decided, in this case, in the courts before we even get to Fiat?
Well, the problem right now is, understand, there are two types of people that are in Chrysler Corporation. One, the hourly people, who are governed by contracts. And over the last number of years now, they've gone from Chrysler to Daimler-Benz, then to Cerberus, now they're going to Fiat. So they're all concerned. It's a new management structure again. Then there's the other side, the salary side. And those people, particularly in the product engineering and manufacturing engineering, they've had a focus. First it was a Chrysler focus, then it became a Daimler-Benz focus, and now here we can come with a new focus, and it's a Fiat focus. So this is like starting up in the morning and starting from scratch.
Yeah.
Jim, just quickly, how much retraining do you think is going to have to go on in order to change this company and change the lines of machines that are coming out of it?
Well, first of all, that's very, very small. Understand that what Fiat is going to bring over here initially is a small car. By the way, that's no new technology. We have mid-sized cars and full-sized cars and full-sized trucks, that kind of technology. Fiat has none of that. So now here comes a small car, but it's still assembled in the same type of sequence. It goes into the body shop to be made. It goes into the paint shop, and it goes down an assembly line. That's very little retraining that are going to have to be done. The sequence of how it's done will be different.
So the challenges are really going to be maintaining confidence of the workers and signaling that they do have some control of their destiny. James Harbor and Tim Garrett, thanks so much for joining us. James Harbor is an automotive industry analyst and retired Ford and Chrysler employee, and Tim Garrett was a retired vice president of administration at Honda Corporation. He spoke with us from Marysville, Ohio. So Carl Ludvigsen joins us now. He's a former executive vice president of Fiat North America. He's in Cambridge, England, in a BBC studio. Carl, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Nice to be with you.
Now, my first question, and forgive me for being a little blunt with you, but Fiat already had trouble in the domestic market in the United States. Why would they want to do it again?
they are interested in having a more substantial base for their product platforms. They don't have enough volume in their own production in Italy to get full value from the engineering they put into each car. And by introducing a 40-mile-per-gallon small car in America to be sold under one of the Chrysler brands, they will extend the volume of their platforms substantially. They're not going to put much in the way of money or management expertise into Chrysler. I think they'll be relying on the Chrysler people to run the company, but they will be investing some technology in Chrysler.
But Fiat is going to have control over, say, the 300, you know, getting rid of that, jettisoning other elements of the product line.
No, they wouldn't take steps of that nature. They want Chrysler to have a broad-based, attractive product range in North America, and they'll build the cars that Chrysler customers want.
Except, Carl, there's a bit of a zero-sum game here. I mean, they're not going to add factories. So if you're manufacturing Fiats, you're not going to be manufacturing trucks.
They'll be making trucks. They'll carry on. The plan is to carry on with the existing product ranges, all those that are viable. They may trim off the Pacifica and some that aren't selling very well. But they'll introduce new American-based models engineered by Chrysler and Auburn Hills, and they'll add a palette of more fuel-efficient small cars.
What do you make of the story reported by Bloomberg and now widely reported that Fiat is taking a look at Opel, the GM division in Europe?
Sergio Marchionne, the boss of Fiat, is meeting this afternoon in Berlin with government officials and officials from GM's European operations. He envisions a new company called Fiat stroke Opel, which would take over the Fiat auto business from Fiat's own holdings and add it to Opel and possibly Saab.
Now, you know, forgive me, I'm not an expert like you, but this looks a little bit like Fiat is prowling a number of fire sales based on the unfortunate demise financially of Chrysler and General Motors, and that this isn't a merger, this isn't even an acquisition, this is more like a garage sale, and that Fiat is basically getting the plums of these two U.S. car companies.
It's making a very modest commitment to Chrysler. It's not costing it anything. It only gets 20% of the shareholding and relatively small amounts. So it's this is a bit of a gamble. The GM Europe situation, on the other hand, is known territory for Fiat. It's only a few years since Fiat and GM unwound a European joint venture.
But in both cases here, Carl, and you know we're pressed a little bit for time, I mean, Fiat is getting these assets for almost nothing compared with what Cerberus got Chrysler for, and let's talk about Daimler, which agreed last week that its 19% stake in Chrysler was essentially worthless.
That's right. Daimler is disposing of that stake as part of these present agreements. But the arrangement in Europe, I think, would cost Fiat something, no question about that. And it would produce a well-integrated company that could be quite a powerhouse in the industry.
Layoffs in the United States?
Yes. I'm more worried about layoffs in Europe, frankly. I think the joint activity of Fiat and Opel would require major layoffs to achieve efficiency.
Finally, foreign automakers in the United States who have set up manufacturing capabilities have not had to deal directly with the United Auto Workers Union. That is not the case in the Fiat Chrysler deal. How well do you think that's going to go?
I think the unions have come to the party in a big way. That was part of the negotiations that Bob Nardelli hoped would avoid bankruptcy. So I think the unions have done a hell of a job of coming to the party. I think they'll be okay on that.
But the UAW will have a 55% stake. Fiat will have an initial 20% stake. There's a potential for some tension there, correct, Carl? A couple of seconds.
Not really. The UAW ownership is actually the pension fund that owns the 55%. So it's kind of at arm's length.
Thanks for setting us straight on that. Carl Ludvigsen is a former executive vice president of Fiat North America, talking to the workers in the U.S. Layoffs, possible. But thanks, Carl.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
You sell the third car, you sell the second car, you know, you downsize, you rent out rooms in your house, but there's a limit to thrift.
My name is Diane DeFaw. I'm calling from Fraser, Michigan. What I'm not willing to give up is decent coffee. Even though it's a lot more precious, my husband and I always buy Starbucks coffee because we prefer the taste. So I can't give that up.
Well, that may be helping Starbucks, but what in the recession are you not willing to give up? The recession-proof item in your budget at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
No, I would say my nails because I can't paint them myself. My girly skills are not good enough. On a more serious topic, it looks like H1N1, popularly known as swine flu, is waning in Mexico. According to the CDC, the virus has sickened 245 people in the U.S., so what lies ahead? Well, a computer simulation out of Northwestern University is taking inspiration from an unusual source, the dollar bill. Donald McNeil Jr. is a science reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and he has a front-page story in today's paper looking at how the virus might spread in the U.S.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So we spoke earlier this morning to a high school English teacher in Oaxaca, which was where the outbreak started.
You know, in my city, the people, they never took precautions, really. Very few people were wearing masks, and even the public radio and TV, they didn't have any announcement for the population.
Does this track with what we've been hearing about, you know, sort of the panic? It sounds as if things were not so panicky there.
Well, it sounds like the typical start of any sort of epidemic in that you have a small upsurge in the number of cases of some disease. I mean, nobody in the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, it was, you know, a tiny number of gay white men in California and New York who noticed, who had unusual symptoms. And nobody had realized that there were thousands of people in Africa infected with the same thing. And it took some years to figure that out. So this, in the early stages of an epidemic, nobody really notices anything is going on, so nobody would have put out a public health warning. It was nearly a month before public health authorities realized we have a new virus circulating and it appears to be more serious than the old viruses.
So what are the large-scale predictions ahead for this virus?
You get people, you know, putting out doomsday scenarios saying we're all dead and this is 1918 all over again, and they are alarmists and shouldn't be listened to. You have other people saying this is absolutely nothing and it's all the media making a fuss and they shouldn't be listened to either. It's going to be somewhere in between. The computer model that I wrote about in this morning's paper predicts around 2,000 to 2,500 cases in the United States by the end of the month. And what's interesting about it is that two different computer models, one at Indiana University and one at Northwestern University, both using very different algorithms and using somewhat different data sets, both came up with roughly the same results.
How did they do it? What's the science in there?
I am not a computer specialist.
No, I know. We don't want to put you there. But I mean, different algorithms, different – I mean, they must have some sort of model that they're tracking.
Well, what's fascinating about the one at Northwestern is that it uses the results, the data from a website called wheresgeorge.com. Which has been around for years, and it's just sort of a fun, whimsical website. And if you and the idea is you might find a dollar bill in your pocket someday that has a little stamp on it saying, you know, log on to wheresgeorge.com, find out where this bill has been. And if you do, you're encouraged to get onto the website and type in the serial numbers of the dollar bills you have in your pocket and type in the zip code where you are, and it may be able to tell you where that bill has been, who's typed that data into the site before. And the guy who designed this website Dirk Brockman out at Northwestern heard about this in just an idle conversation with a carpenter in Vermont one day and thought, this is great. This is exactly what I need, because exchanges of dollar bills are face-to-face transactions, which is exactly how disease is transmitted too. So, and it turned out that they had the tracks of $100 million bills on the website. And if you track them all, you can basically make a map of all the face-to-face transactions and how something moves across the United States, what patterns it uses. Because it doesn't follow the highways. I mean, people exchange money in different ways. I mean, of course, it goes to most of the major metropolitan areas and stuff, as bills do, but it allows you to show face-to-face transactions. And then he compared that later to another data set that showed how cell phones move across the United States as the signal is picked up from tower to tower to tower, and it showed roughly the same map, which gave him a lot of confidence in this data.
And what's the CDC saying at this point? Because they're giving a hard number. One question is always if the number has been a little bit cautious, whether it's an underestimation. What is the CDC saying about what lies ahead?
The CDC is saying they don't know what the epidemic is going to do, but it's not nothing. It's not trivial. We're not out of the woods. We should pay attention to it. We're lucky in that it seems to be moving. It seems to be slightly on the decline in Mexico. All the cases in the United States have been mild. It seems to be moving fairly slowly, but that's what happens when you put people on alert for a disease. And we're moving into the summer months when flu normally transmits more slowly.
But it seems in general that unlike the normal slogan, which is a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, in this particular case, a lot of knowledge is dangerous in the sense that it doesn't really help us understand what the personal threat is to each one of us.
There is no amount of knowledge you can get that will predict the future. People ask me, come up to my desk, and the basic question they were asking is, will I die? And, of course, the easy answer is, sure, eventually, someday.
pretty tense over there at the Times. So.
But will I die from this flu? I don't think so. You know, even if we were in 1918, you had a 98% chance of survival, and now we've got Tamiflu and we will have a vaccine, so probably we will all be safe, but... take precautions.
One last thing. Is this really a more deadly flu than the typical winter flus that have been happening over the past few years?
It has a tendency to kill a very small number of young, healthy people, which is different from typical flu.
All right. Thanks. We were talking to Donald McNeil, Jr., science reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And he has a front page story in today's paper looking at how the virus might spread in the U.S. Now we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. An array of severe weather that hit several southern states may not be done quite yet. The powerful storms killed one woman in Mississippi and high winds damaged property and knocked out power in many locations. Meteorologist John DeBlock from the National Weather Service says that a storm system that moved across central Alabama has caused a lot of damage.
A swath of damage from the Mississippi state line all the way to the Georgia state line. We've had thousands of trees blown down across that area.
Several tornado reports came in over the weekend, and forecasters say that the bad weather could stick around through today. Iraq refuses to extend the deadline for American troops to get out of its cities. The current deal requires U.S. forces to leave by June the 30th. Recent increases in violence had fueled some speculation that Iraq's government might become flexible on the timetable. Today, Iraq says that it's committed to the June the 30th deadline. A new report out this morning says that an American journalist held prisoner in Iran was briefly hospitalized. The press freedom group Reporters Without Borders says that Roxana Shabari had to go to a prison clinic after she stopped drinking water. Her father says she has been fasting to protest her jailing on spying charges. That's your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. We want you to go to our website at thetakeaway.org because we've got this interesting story on how, despite the economy, families are still shelling out for prom. It got us thinking that you probably have your own pleasures and luxuries that you won't cut out of your budget. Tell us, what are you still willing to spend your money on? Economy be damned. Maybe
I want that dress. That's the dress I want.
I have to say, John, your dress is looking fabulous today.
Thank you so much.
Maybe it's some fancy pet food. I don't know. Tell us what is recession-proof in your budget at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake at thetakeaway.org.
So Secretary Tim Geithner, how stressed are our banks? I mean, do you think we're going to find out on Thursday?
To get through this and try to resolve that uncertainty and restore basic confidence and the strength of these, you have to start by doing a careful assessment of how large those losses may be.
That's Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner talking about the so-called stress tests for the big banks on the Charlie Rose Show back on March 10th. Well, they've done their careful assessment, but they've delayed several times giving us the results of those assessments. How significant are they, especially as there are some glimmering signs that possibly the bottom has been reached in certain sectors of the economy and things are beginning to turn around in certain places? Peter Morici joins us, economist and professor at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. He joins us from his home in Virginia. I guess, Peter, you're about to get on the Beltway and head up to University of Maryland there?
Actually, I'm going to give a speech to the American Foundry Society at noon. Is here to, I guess, meet with, you know, go up to on the Hill and lobby and so forth.
All right. Well, congratulations. I hope you tell them some good news because some of your forecasts suggest that there is some good news in the economy. My first question to you is, have we passed the point where the health of the banks is, as we've been told, central to the health of the broad economy?
Oh, the health of the banks remains a critical issue. I mean, we need to keep a very watchful eye because with a lag, we're going to see the effect of store closures at places like Circuit City. You know, they're now vacating their storefronts. Those guys can't pay their rent. So the guys who own the stores can't pay their mortgages, and banks will start writing down those loans in the summer. So there's going to be new bank losses this summer. That doesn't mean the economy can't and isn't turning around by fall or winter. But it is yet something else to watch.
How much is this stress test story? And we've been told that we're going to get the results on Thursday, but again, it's been delayed a few times, as I mentioned. How much is this story solely about Bank of America and Citigroup?
No, it's not just about Bank of America and Citigroup. They're testing the 19 largest banks against a scenario in which housing prices continue to fall through the end of next year and unemployment continues to rise through next year. That's a rather severe scenario, and they're going to assess their need for paid-in common shares or the very best capital that banks hold to back up loans. And several regional banks, because of the commercial real estate problems, will be found wanting and told to raise capital. The trouble is that's going to be like the scarlet letter, and it's going to make it very difficult for them to raise capital, and especially because the federal government says, well, it would come in with capital if, you know, from the TARP. It would buy common shares. And the last thing after the Chrysler debacle anyone wants is to own shares in a bank that the federal government also owns shares in.
So the issue really, let me just sort of pretend to be a central banker, okay, or not a central banker, but one of these big bank CEOs, all right? So I fail the stress test. Basically, the federal government says to me, you have to go raise capital. At that point, I pick up the phone and say, hi, I need a few billion, just failed the stress test. The federal government pretty much says that I can't make it through the next year. Can you cough up $2 or $3 billion for me? That's a preposterous offer. Is that what you're saying?
Now you understand why Mr. Geithner, by folks like me, is considered a bumbler in Washington. Only a fool would invent a contraption like this.
Well,
he's neither an economist nor a banker, so they were sitting around, talking as the boys do in the dormitory, as the sophomores do, and they come up with this numbskull idea, and they hand it in their term paper, and the president approved it. And, you know, now we've got this problem.
So Geithner sort of flunks Morici 303, right?
Well, that's assuming a lot, because he's still back trying to repeat 101 for the fourth time. I mean, this isn't the first, you know, thing he's sort of fumbled up there. You know, but in any case, this is a preposterous situation.
How much does this reflect what might happen with smaller banks? I know that they're not subject to the stress test, but do you have any sense of how the, is anyone trying to predict the equivalent of the stress test on smaller banks, community banks?
Well, this is what regulators do all the time. They do look at the capital adequacy of banks, but they just don't subject them to such severe tests. You see, with smaller banks, if they get in trouble, the FDIC essentially comes in the way the TARP would and reorganizes the assets and sells them to a larger bank. The reason we go through this with larger banks is they are becoming increasingly difficult to sell to other banks. After all, after the Merrill Lynch sale to Bank of America and what the federal government did to Bank of America, if you were a number 12 bank, would you let the federal government sell you number 18? So, you know, the federal government's trying to avoid situations where it might have to reorganize and sell a bank to another bank.
But in that scenario, it's always you aggregate upward, that the combined bank is going to be bigger than the constituent parts. And how does that jive with this call by economists in various sorts of congressional hearings that we can't allow these banks to get bigger and bigger? Their very size is really the problem. The federal government seems to be in the business of making
size. The top eight banks are really too big. You know, they're like 60% of the marketplace. The smaller banks down the ladder, they're very tiny. Combining them actually makes them stronger and better able to compete with the big banks. A lot of the problem with these very small banks that get into trouble is they're not diversified enough in terms of where their loans are. So, you know, there's really big banks that are a problem, and there are really small banks that are a problem. You know, it's like car companies. You can't be too small, but you can't be too big either, or you get too bureaucratic.
Well, Peter, I'm going to let you go, but let me just get a yes or no from you. Do you buy this federal stress test scenario that unemployment and rises through the end of the year and housing prices decline through the end of the year?
Through the end of next year, no.
A positive note from Peter Morici. Thanks so much for joining us. Peter Morici is economist and professor at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
21 minutes to the top of the hour. Italian carmaker Fiat already owns a major part of Chrysler. Now it's going after General Motors as well. GM's European holdings include Germany's Opel and UK's Vauxhall, and Fiat wants to get its hands on both. GM's holdings also include the much-loved but often troubled Swedish carmaker Saab, but it's not clear what will happen to it since it's being reorganised under Swedish law. Well, markets are mostly doing well this morning. Several European indices have seen some gains. In Asia, the jump has been dramatic, with some markets closing up around about 5%. An array of good news is boosting the rally. H1N1, or swine flu, fears are receding. There's also good news in new reports about American and Chinese manufacturing. President Obama rolls out a new tax plan later this morning. It targets overseas tax havens. Companies and people who use accounts in places like the Cayman Islands and Bahamas will get hit for hundreds of billions of dollars. The plan wouldn't take effect until 2011. H1N1, or swine flu, cases jumped over the weekend, but scientists around the world are pointing to hopeful news in the latest numbers. The Centers for Disease Control says that the increase in confirmed cases is because of a new test and new test results rather than a jump in new infections. Let's look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. On Wednesday night in his primetime press conference, President Barack Obama made an astounding claim.
This budget builds on the steps we've taken over the last 100 days to move this economy from recession to recovery and ultimately to prosperity. We began by passing a Recovery Act that has already saved or created over 150,000 jobs and provided a tax cut to 95% of all working families.
Now, the president says 150,000 jobs were created by the Recovery Act, but it turns out those aren't exactly real jobs. Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein has done her own digging into President Obama's math. Hey, how you doing?
Good morning, Farai. How are you?
Great. And so what are these jobs that the president's talking about?
Oh, well, it turns out that these are jobs that have gone through processing at the OMB and the Council of Economic Advisers, and they've put together an estimate based on how much money they have released to the states, but they're not actually real jobs.
Now, have.
Oh.
Yeah, I know.
Got
that?
They're just not real. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a whiff of a mission accomplished about this. The,
she's
the claim
tough.
That 150,000 jobs have been saved or created. It's not that no money's gone out. A lot of money's gone out. I mean, states like New York, California, their budgets were in danger of just cratering. And this fiscal stabilization money helped, you know, keep those state budgets alive. There were people that were not laid off because of that. There are people that are getting money for Medicaid, for food stamps, for unemployment, and all of that money is being spent. But when you call the states individually and you say, well, what jobs have been created, the states are much more conservative. For example, the state of Massachusetts said, well, we can only say one job now. That's our infrastructure czar, because we haven't really started the road building projects. New York, one of the biggest states, says 50 people. Washington state says 25 people. Maryland says, well, we are not really sure yet, because these jobs are just going out to bid and just starting now. So, you know, it's not like the vision that you might have of, you know, an army of people going out and building roads and bridges and mass transit. These are estimates, and it's not clear when actually there will be 150,000 people put to work because of the Recovery Act.
I thought this was all supposed to be shovel-ready, you know, that whole term shovel-ready. So will we ever know?
Well,
you know, kind of what?
Right. In fairness to the states, I mean, it does take time to bid out a job. You don't want to give it to literally any crook. You don't want to give it to the concrete boots contracting company. So, you know, all of this does take time. I mean, these projects were ready to go, but the Recovery Act was passed in February, so it's not even 3 months. Will we ever know? We'll probably have a much clearer idea, say, a year from now. But the General Accounting Office just put out a report, and it said that of the 29 states it surveyed, these states were really struggling with how to account for this. And, you know, this has been the hallmark of the Obama administration. We want transparency. We want to tell you what we're doing. And OMB is expected to issue some guidance this week on how to count. But it is really tough. And certainly we don't have 150,000 boots on the ground as a today, May 4th.
Andrea, is it really up to the states to do self-reporting and you know, there really isn't a lot of fact-checking?
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the things, problems with the whole stimulus bill, is that so much is up to the states. But the federal government is trying to give them some guidelines. And I think, you know, one of the things I got as I was calling around the country talking to states was, you know, we really want to know from the federal government how we're supposed to count before
right.
we tell you this. On the other hand, the president can make any claim he wants. He's the president.
All right. Well, Andrea, thanks so much. Andrea Bernstein, Takeaway correspondent.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. So this economy has you scrimping and saving, but there are some pleasures that are just worth it, right? You can tell us, what are you still willing to spend your money on?
This is Matt Larson calling from Salt Lake City. Just calling to say that the bad economy, the one thing I don't cut out is my cigars. It's something I enjoy doing.
Well, no matter how big or small, call us with your guilty pleasures, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now we have Femi Oke with the news.
Good morning. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Two unions representing some Boston Globe workers announced this morning that they have reached agreements with the newspaper's owners, our partner, the New York Times Company. However, negotiations with the largest union aren't finished. They continued past a midnight deadline last night. The Times says that it's prepared to file a 60-day shutdown notice if the union doesn't agree to millions of dollars in cuts. However, even if a notice is filed, it's not irrevocable, and sometimes financial conditions change during that period. The Globe is projected to lose $85 million this year. Mexicans are adapting to life indoors. People have remained inside to decrease the spread of the H1N1 virus. Churchgoers celebrated Mass via television, and all-pro soccer games were played in empty stadiums. Mexico decides today whether to end the nationwide shutdown. Bipartisan praise is piling up this morning for a legendary Republican. Jack Kemp died of cancer over the weekend. The Buffalo congressman was Republican vice president nominee back in 1996, and here he is during an October 1996 debate where he was running with Bob Dole.
They think we're at our fullest capacity, that we've reached our potential, and that 2.5% growth is enough for America. Frankly, that's just not good enough for this country. We cannot just run the clock out on the 20th century.
Kemp fought hard for big tax cuts and is widely credited for making it the signature Republican issue it is today.
Quarterback for the Buffalo Bills.
And yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So, it's Monday, folks.
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
I don't know about you, but Monday here at The Takeaway means Marcus Mabry on our agenda segment. He's the international business editor and author here from our partner, The New York Times. Marcus, thanks so much for coming into the studio once again.
Good to be here, Joe.
It is safe to say that looking forward to this week, the Obama administration probably has in its mind the notion that vigilance does not necessarily equal a sense of control over events. Swine flu and, you know, the N1 virus being an example of that. How does that figure in the events of this week?
Well, this will be an interesting week because this is going to be a week when it's all about confidence. You know, the fulcrum of capitalism is actually not markets, it's confidence. And confidence is what makes markets work. And so the administration will be working this week to restore some confidence. And what we believe is going to happen is we believe these stress tests, the big event on Thursday, kind of the climax of the, as we try to restore confidence in the economy, Obama week, will probably engender more hope than fear at this point, is what we suspect. They're going to actually try to make the case that America's banks are not insolvent. And that's what the test of the 19 biggest bankers probably going to show.
But before we get to Thursday, Monday today, we're going to get some realtor information, which could be very, very negative. And on Tuesday, we're going to hear from the TARP Oversight Committee. And last time, they trashed the sense of the administration's oversight program on the TARP. How are they going to get through Monday and Tuesday?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we'll get our first sense about, you know, this housing market, which has been the central to this negative economy we've been seeing, and the hopes that it is bottoming out, that we're at least decelerating at a slower pace than we were before economically. We're going to get some numbers to see if that's true. Have we reached a bottom in some places? Are we going near a bottom, perhaps, based on what the National Realtors Association say? So we're going to get some sense of that. Ben Bernanke is going to be talking throughout the week, both on Tuesday and on Thursday, trying to say that we're looking at bank oversight, and we are going to have a new regulatory framework than we've had before, so that the TARP money actually won't just be money down a rat hole, which is exactly, of course, what the administration's critics claim it is.
So on Wednesday, we shift gears away from the economy, and in your paper this morning, your colleague David Sanger has a story about how U.S. officials are suddenly concerned as the Taliban enters Bunir province in Pakistan, which I believe is like 70 miles or so from Islamabad,
right,
about the nuclear capability of Pakistan, the nukes being allegedly located somewhere south of Islamabad. Here's President Obama talking about his concerns on South Asia.
We want to respect their sovereignty, but we also recognize that we have huge strategic interests, huge national security interests in making sure that Pakistan is stable and that you don't end up having a nuclear-armed militant state.
Now, on Wednesday, the president is going to be welcoming the president or the prime minister of Pakistan, as well as the president, so far as we know, the president,
yes.
I mean, that's a term of art, of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. What are the issues there, aside from simply projecting the concern that Pakistan remains stable?
Well, what David Sanger's piece in the front page of the paper points out this morning is what the stakes are here. And we do have a nuclear-armed state in the form of Pakistan. And the fact that you have militants that are making increasing gains in that country, David Gates, the Secretary of Defense, was saying...
Robert Gates,
the Secretary of Defense over the weekend, was saying that it was actually the incursions by the Taliban that actually kind of underlined the fragility of Pakistan. And the question is, as Hillary Clinton was saying last week, the question is how secure are the nuclear facilities, and increasingly intelligence folks are worried about something being lost in transport, say, if there was, thanks to some Taliban sympathizer within the government, transport information that got out to militants, and they would actually be able to seize something, whether it be enriched plutonium or whether it be actual arms, on transit throughout the country. That's a real worry. it's something that the president keeps saying continually, echoing the Pakistanis, that they have their command and control under control, that they're not worried about that. But we, you know, we can't really know as the Taliban makes increasing incursions.
But what's the tone of these meetings? Is it going to be prove to me you're stable, meet these goals, and Hamid Karzai, prove to me you can win an election and hold Afghanistan together? Or is it going to be more kind of touchy-feely, I'm on your side, don't worry?
Well, I think the Obama administration will, and it will be great to see what comes out of these meetings, because they all need a win. The U.S. needs a win here, and both of those leaders need a win to show that they're actually in control of their destinies of their nations. It's going to be a really tight line the administration will be walking between that exactly. You know, show us the proof that you guys are in control, and not treading so heavily on them that either of them becomes, in fact, weaker at home.
Marcus, you know, we're used to talking about the national security impact of Pakistan, but what about the economy? You're the international business editor, and we're talking here about giving aid directly related to the national security interests, but what are our financial interests with Pakistan?
Well, it's dire at this point. We've gotten to this point where the security and the finance are actually overlapping. For instance, Hillary Clinton was up on the Hill last week, and she was saying that without further assistance, Pakistan would actually be running out of money to actually fight against the Taliban insurgency. It's mind-boggling. We've given them millions already just to secure the nuclear weapons, as we were discussing.
So this week is really politically all about the specter of Spectre, right?
Well, you know, this is it. This is the first time we'll have the senator, the former Republican senator from Pennsylvania, now the Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, caucusing with the Democratic caucus. So it's going to be interesting to see how this works out. Now, Spector has said over and over again he's not going to be a pushover. He's not going to be a rubber stamp for his fellow Democrats in the Senate. But, you know, we'll start to see, you know, the kind of juggling act that Alan Spector will be doing for the rest of his term today, this week.
And the Democrats are or are not handing out T-shirts with the number 60 on the front and
back. Well, you know, as soon as Al Franken gets to Washington, they may make those, print those up.
Roll the printers. Mr. Franken goes to Washington. On that note, we'll end the agenda this Monday morning. Author and international business editor for our partners, The New York Times, Marcus Mabry. Thanks, as always. Right.
And, well, we're going back to the money issue. Everybody's cutting back, but there's certain things that you just don't want to give up. So we want to know, what are you willing to spend your money on that's not dire, do or die? Now, fancy pet food, manicures, pedicures.
Fancy pet food? What's that? Like, with a fringe?
You know, some people have, like, they just love this one kind of pet food. You know, organic baby food. Anyway, maybe you're scrapping organic cookies and ice cream for something healthier.
Brooke O'Hara, and I'm calling from New York City. And one thing I don't give up is organic meats and vegetables.
We want to know what's recession-proof in your budget, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You could weigh in on our website about all those Supreme Court nominations we asked you to deliver last week when the Souter story broke. We're going to keep following what you say, and we've got a tally when a new justice is announced. Here's your takeaway this morning.
Will I die from this flu? I don't think so. You know, even if we were in 1918, you had a 98% chance of survival. And now we've got Tamiflu and, you know, we will have a vaccine. So probably we will all be safe. But take precautions.
Settling us all down, that's Donald McNeil, science reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Of course, if you missed that or anything else on the program, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
Wash your hands all the time. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Finding a club that would have him as a member.
When I came to the Senate, you had a room full of moderate Republicans, Hines and Weicker and Stafford and Chafee and Danforth and on.
Senator Arlen Specter explains his switch from the GOP to the Democrats as the GOP tries to figure out who should be a member of the Republican Party these days. So come give me a hug. 2 cents worth on the future of the GOP. Short of Fitty. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, Monday, May 4th. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm joined this morning in the studio by Farai Chidea. Hey, Farai, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Hey, John. Coming up this hour, we're going to discuss the upcoming visit by the Afghan and Pakistani presidents. We're also going to talk with a former Republican congressman about how the GOP could rebuild its image. And the prom, it's usually a night of big spending, but is that changing with the recession? Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
H1N1, maybe not as serious as we thought. That's according to Richard Besser of the CDC. He told CBS News that preventive steps such as closing schools may still be a good idea.
Well, I think we're gaining more information, and we may be able to make some movement on that. We close schools to prevent transmission from children to children, but also to prevent spread in the community.
A New York City high school with 45 confirmed cases reopened today after being closed all week. Meanwhile, schools in New Mexico and Arizona have announced closures. There have been 226 confirmed cases here in the U.S. Farai?
Well, the Italian car maker Fiat is in talks to buy parts of the European business of General Motors, including Vauxhall and Opel. Auto analyst John McElroy says that won't make everyone at GM happy.
They've had some pretty bad business connections between GM and Fiat in the past, and GM would be very chagrined to see Fiat taking over everything that it's got in Europe.
GM has been trying to find investors for its non-core assets to help stave off collapse. Fiat is already planning to take major stakes in Chrysler, and two unions representing some Boston Globe workers announced this morning they've reached agreements with the newspaper's owner, our partner, the New York Times Company. Negotiations aren't finished. They continued past a midnight deadline, and the Times says it's prepared to file a 60-day shutdown notice if the union doesn't agree to millions in cuts.
That's a cliffhanger up there in Boston. President Obama is expected to unveil a new plan that would change federal tax policy. It would do away with some deductions for companies that earn profits in countries with low tax rates. It also targets individuals who use tax havens. Asian markets this morning were higher. Japan's Nikkei up nearly 2%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng up more than 5%. You may have noticed that the name of my co-host, Adore Udoji, is missing from the show this morning. There's a good reason for that. As you've heard over the last several weeks, Adora and her husband recently adopted a new baby. She let us know last week that she's giving up the host chair here at The Takeaway to spend more time with her new daughter, and we wish her all the best. As we begin to look for someone to fill the chair, I'll be joined by Farai and others in the coming weeks, so stay tuned. Here in the U.S., the Dow opens today at 8212. The S&P kicks off at 878. Later in the show, we're going to learn about people's limits to thrift.
I don't know why, but shopping for vinyl records is recession-proof. It's one of those weird obsessions that you just can't break.
Some people won't scrimp on the prom. We're going to find that out later in the program. What's recession-proof in your budget? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. We begin in Washington, Afghanistan, and Pakistan all at once this morning. Afghan President Hamid Karzai and Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari are set to visit Washington later this week. And is it at all possible that the notion of Taliban nukes is going to be on the table when those leaders sit down with the president and with administration officials? As Taliban forces make on-the-ground encroachments inside Pakistan in Bunir province, tantalizingly near Islamabad, south of Islamabad, according to the New York Times, the Pakistani nuclear arsenal is located. Is that an actual issue for the United States government, which has to decide how many millions of dollars they're going to be delivering to Pakistan as an emergency security arrangement? Joining us now to set all of this in context, especially the Afghanistan elections and administration support for Hamid Karzai, is Christine Fair, senior political scientist for the RAND Corporation. She joins us from Virginia this morning. Christine, thanks for coming back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, David Sanger on the front page of the New York Times has this story about U.S. officials concerned with Taliban successes on the battlefield in Pakistan, suggesting that there may be some threat to the nuclear arsenal in Pakistan. Is that something that is likely to come up explicitly in talks with Zardari and Barack Obama later this week?
Well, you know, and obviously I have no insight in what the talking points are for that meeting. I think there is a fairly widespread consensus that the arsenal is actually safe when they're in their depot. I don't know too many people that believe that the Taliban are going to stage an assault on the facilities and abscond with a weapon, especially since the weapons are actually not stored in an assembled state. The cores are apart from the warhead. The warheads unassembled are obviously apart from the missiles. One of the issues that does concern me, and it's been concerning a few of my colleagues, is that Pakistan is a means of providing security for their small but nonetheless fastest-growing arsenal. It tends to move them around, and that is to ensure a first or survivable strike capability. And my concern is not when they're in the depot, but actually when they leave the depot, because many of the places that they're moving around in are, you know, quite vulnerable. And we've seen Pakistan convoys being attacked by militants in many other contexts. And, you know, I like to remind my Pakistani colleagues who try to assure me that there's no problem that a year or so ago, the United States lost several nuclear weapons as they were flying over in aircraft above the United States. And, you know, we've spent several decades and billions of dollars trying to ensure that that would never happen, yet, in fact, it did.
Well, that's a really good point. So outside of the nuclear issue, it seems as though the White House has put out some sort of feeler or has offered some sort of contact with Nawaz Sharif, the popular opposition leader who stands in marked contrast to President Zardari, who, while he is in power, is widely viewed as very, very unpopular and ineffectual. How's that going to work?
Well, you know, the problem with the U.S. engagement strategy is it really is stovepiped, and it tends to center around one personality. So during the Musharraf years, it was all Musharraf all the time. Now it's publicly Zardari, but privately Kayani. And because
Can you describe who Kayani is?
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry. Yeah, he's the current chief of Army staff. He was Musharraf's successor in that capacity of Army chief. So actually, given that Zardari is nearly universally loathed, his approval rating is in the single digits. Nawaz Sharif, in contrast, has a much higher approval rating. It seems as if there were an election today, and if he were allowed to contest that election, because, of course, he's not allowed to at this point because of the Supreme Court ruling. So the United States is actually being pretty smart in trying to reach out to the leadership that has, in fact, the majority of support. And, you know, if Nawaz Sharif were to come out even more strongly than he has against the Taliban, that would actually be very helpful in trying to get Pakistanis to understand the threat that quite frankly, really does potentially undermine the security of their state.
Is an emergency aid package something that's going to actually work here to satisfy U.S. concerns about the confrontation with the Taliban, or does that money simply go into various programs that meet the needs and the agenda of Pakistani officials, be they military or civilian?
Well, I'm of really mixed minds. One does have to ask the question as to why Pakistan, despite being the beneficiary of relatively significant largesse for six decades, still has problems. Now, one philosophy in the aid community, and I believe there's a book about this, Why Aid Kills in Africa, is that when you have so much external support, it actually allows the government to never come to terms with priorities. It doesn't have to forge a relationship between the government and the governed by extracting resources and redelivering, and it doesn't have to make tough decisions about its excessively funded conventional military forces to fight India and its poorly configured capabilities to fight insurgency within its country, as well as to provide education, health, and health care. So one philosophy says that aid actually hurts because it allows the state to continue pressing on with irresponsible priorities with complete lack of responsiveness to the people. And so I actually do buy that in considerable measure. That being said, the second problem with aid to Pakistan has been the modalities of it. We have a very small footprint in the country because of the security issues. And for given the importance of the country, our mission in Pakistan is actually quite small. And so the preference is always going to be for cash assistance in the form of budgetary support. And when you give budgetary support, that is when, how shall I put it, funds become highly fungible. And the U.S. on a number of programs, I've had officials tell me, we don't know where the money went. We know we transferred it to the ministry, but then the money disappeared.
And that's been going on really since the 80s when Pakistan was the setting for the Mujahideen fighting
in
Afghanistan.
Exactly. It's a longstanding pattern.
Very quickly, Nawaz Sharif's popularity comes from his closer ties to the Islamists in Pakistan. Isn't that a problem if the U.S. is going to open a channel to him?
Well, that's actually not where his popularity comes from. That's a big misperception about Nawaz Sharif. He did flirt with this thing called Sharia in his second term. That wasn't about turning Pakistan into a Talibanized state. It was really about protecting him from the army. He knew the army was coming after him. He had played generals off of each other. He had fired two chiefs of army staff. The third didn't put up with it. That was obviously President Musharraf, who took over in 1989. And he, trying to institute Sharia, had hoped to curry favor with the Saudis that would also put pressure on the army to protect him. And so much of his good track record, cooperating with the U.S. on counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, he actually had a very good record. And he's actually very grateful to the United States because the United States, quite frankly, saved his life because
right.
Musharraf may have killed him.
Indeed.
So his popularity comes from the fact that he has stayed to constitutional principles, and he's been the antithesis of Zardari. That's where his popularity comes from.
And Christine, how much are these countries collaborating anyway to really deal with the Taliban? Are they equipped to really be a united force, even if they get money?
Well, the problem is the Pakistan Army has said repeatedly it does not want to be a counterinsurgency force, which is needed to repel the Pakistan Taliban. The police, which is predominantly the victim of Taliban strikes and related organizations like the Frontier Constabulary, which is a very poorly trained outfit but are supposed to function as police, they are so poorly equipped, they are poorly trained, they are poorly manned, and they are basically sitting ducks to be picked off by the insurgents. The United States has really lost an opportunity in the last 8 years by vesting all of its resources in the Pakistan Army and really paying scant regard to the nation's police forces. Yet the counterinsurgency literature is very clear that police win insurgencies, not armies.
Christine, we have about a minute and a half here, and we can't avoid talking about Afghanistan. How do you think Barack Obama is going to phrase the term President Karzai? Gosh, I'm so sorry I snubbed you for those 8 weeks. Welcome back into the fold when he meets with the Afghan president, who he really hasn't gone out of his way to cultivate, it seems to me, in the early going here.
Well, look, the international community is really between a rock and a hard place. Karzai has been universally disappointing. He has not moved on corruption. He has protected drug lords, and there's all sorts of suspicions, probably more justifiable than not, about his brother in Kandahar being involved in drug trade. He spent more time tirading against the international security forces killing Afghan civilians than the Taliban, who do the same. But we're kind of in a predicament because of the decision to delay the elections to August and the lapse of Karzai's term, which is looming, there is not a constitutional president between now and August. This is also the key fighting time. So the U.S., even though, it wants to support a process to get a president, in point of fact, it's basically had to say
right.
We support government continuity.
Christine Fair, senior political scientist for the RAND Corporation, on Afghanistan and Pakistan's meeting this week in Washington with the Obama administration.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know, even in this economy, there's a limit to thrift, okay?
Hi, my name is Bonnie from the Garden State Parkway. The one thing that I will not give up is a cleaning woman to come in twice a month and do all the stuff that, because I work full-time, it's really hard for me to do.
Priorities and hard realities in this economy. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What won't you give up? Is it the prom? Is it a recession-proof cup of coffee in the morning? Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hey, I'm not going to give up my newspaper because otherwise I would be completely uninformed for our show. Let's talk about political news. Some Republicans view Senator Arlen Specter's high-profile switch to the Democratic Party last week as a huge blow. Others are saying it's good riddance to bad rubbish. The senator's move is just the latest in a series of blows for Republicans who are trying to stay relevant in Washington. Now, you got party leadership being overshadowed by media figures like Rush Limbaugh, fighting over message, cries from some party moderates that they're being pushed out by hardliners. That's a lot of issues to deal with. New Hampshire's Charlie Bass spent 12 years in Congress before losing his seat in 2006, and we've got him on the line to talk about what Republicans need to do to rebuild and maintain a broad appeal to the American public. Thanks for joining us, and let's talk straight off about what's happened to the Republican Party. What do you think's been evolving over the past few years?
Well, you know, as we commemorate the passing of Jack Kemp, over the weekend, he was the father of the concept that taxes could be reduced and the budget would actually, revenues would increase and the economy would be stronger. But Jack Kemp was not known, frankly, as a candidate, a social crusader. Now the Republican Party is a party that really appeals to the South and to the East and the Southwest and the in those parts of the country where social values are important projections in government, and it's creating a lot of discord in the party. Arlen Specter's switch to the Democratic Party is not about philosophy. It's about politics and winning the primary in Pennsylvania. It's always been hard for moderate Republicans or Democrats to win primaries in states. When I ran in 1994, that was the most difficult election I had, the primary, because of the fact that the extremes in both parties generally tend to vote in primaries. So Arlen Specter's defection to the Democrats, frankly, doesn't really change the pattern of voting in the Senate, even though you have one more Democratic senator.
I do want to talk just briefly more about Jack Kemp. I got a chance to do some political analysis with him back when I worked at CNN in 1996. He was a true gentleman and a pleasure to work with. Now, in a 96 campaign rally, then vice presidential nominee Kemp gave the Republican Party a new nickname.
To our friendly critics, this is not the grand old party anymore. After San Diego, after Colin Powell and Christy Todd Whitman and Bob Dole and Jack Kemp, this is the Grand Opportunity Party for America in 1996.
So what happened to that opportunity?
Well, I mean, the Republicans in 1994 took over at a point where President Clinton and the Democrats were foundering on issues that really were out of step with the American people. And Ronald Reagan and later others, frankly, Newt Gingrich was one of them, talked about issues that independent voters were attracted to: reform of the Congress, term limits, balanced budgets, lower deficits, and so forth. That message was lost when the Republicans, over time, when the Republicans were in power. Conversely, the Democrats, despite the fact that they were led by very liberal individuals, moved their message to the center very, very expertly and capitalized on certain issues that Republicans had, scandal and so forth, in order to take over. Now the Republicans are trying to seek their sort of center of gravity again, and that's what this controversy is all about. The pendulum of politics swings back and forth. At present, it's on the Democratic side. The Republicans are trying to figure out where they're headed, but it'll turn and the pendulum will swing the other way.
Well, you know, that's a point that Senator Specter made himself. He had this to say on Meet the Press.
The Republican Party has gone far to the right since I joined it under Reagan's big tent. When I came to the Senate, you had a room full of moderate Republicans, Hines and Weicker and Stafford and Chafee and Danforth and on and on. And in recent times, I have diverged materially from the Republican line.
So, Congressman, former Congressman Charlie Bass, let me just ask you directly. You know, the Republican Party, you know, is in this incremental shift. But I'm wondering if it's a quid pro quo here. Basically, looking at that number 60, Specter basically went to the Democrats and said, hey, we can reform the court. We can do all kinds of things here. All of a sudden, Souter announces his retirement. The number 60 seems to be magic here.
There's a difference between Franken beating Coleman and entering the Senate and Arlen Specter changing parties. We know what Arlen Specter's voting record is. He's been a Republican for 30 years. He's a moderate Republican, but he's a Republican. He may change his position on card check. He may not. But the fact is that the impact on the legislative side of Arlen Specter being a Republican, a Democrat, or a Specterist is not going to make much difference. He's going to be the same. He will not change materially his record.
No, you said that on the legislative side, but it could have a huge impact on the court.
That's true. But then again, Arlen Specter is the same person he was before he switched. He would still be voting either for or against Supreme Court nominees based upon his own standards. I think the votes are there anyway for Obama's choice for the Supreme Court, as long as that individual obviously doesn't have what I would call non-judicial issues of sorts. And Specter will address the nominee issue as a Democrat the same as he would as a Republican, in my opinion. I think that Specter's switch to the Democratic Party was solely based on the fact that he wants to stay in the Senate, and he knew he couldn't win the primary next year. And the rest of the issues, and he's admitted it publicly, as we all know, are secondary.
Well, Congressman, thanks so much. And we've been speaking to New Hampshire's former Congressman Charlie Bass. And now we have the current reporter, Femi Okay, with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Italian carmaker Fiat is on quite a shopping trip lately. It already owns a sizable slice of Chrysler. Now it is looking at General Motors property. GM's European holdings include Germany's Opel and the UK's Vauxhall. Fiat may get its hands on both. GM holdings also include the Swedish carmaker Saab, but it's not clear what will happen to it since it's being reorganised under Swedish law. Iraq refuses to extend the deadline for American troops to get out of its city. The current deal requires US forces to leave by June the 30th. Recent increases in violence have fueled speculation that deadline might move. Iraq government says it's sticking by the June the 30th date. And that's your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. I just saw that Filene's is filing for bankruptcy. That's where I used to buy all my fancy outfits when I was going to school in Cambridge, Mass.
Right. So CNN is reporting it at this point. We'll have more details maybe a little bit later on. Market's open as well.
Yeah, well, what I'm thinking is, you know, that's a place where you go for things that you like, that you don't really need, but you like. And so we're asking, what do you like that you're still spending money on? Economy be damned.
Hi, it's Betty Ann, and I'm calling from New York City, and I won't give up the great gray lady.
That's the New York Times, our partner. Jerry writes on our site, I can't help myself. I keep ordering courses on sale from the teaching company. Tell us what's recession-proof in your budget, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So, big sports weekend. That means there's tons of sports to get caught up on this Monday. And, you know, it was a chance that the Chicago Bulls had to do it without Michael Jordan, but it didn't quite work out.
I thought we played more physical, a lot tougher in the second half. Tried to spread them out with a smaller lineup. We just couldn't make enough shots to put really any real pressure on them. We cut it close a few times, but, you know, I'm really just proud of the way my players, you know, fought.
That's Bulls coach Vinny Del Negro, who said his team fought to the end, but it wasn't much of a contest in the seventh game, even after all the double and triple overtimes in this first-round series between the Chicago Bulls and the Boston Celtics. The Celtics advance. The Bulls go home. Here in the studio is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports blogger and takeaway contributor. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
So that was a nail-biter, but it's only round one of the NBA playoffs.
I'm exhausted. I'm completely exhausted. It's like your eyes are completely wide open the entire time. They played almost eight games full of basketball, and literally everybody who watched it, they're exhausted.
But it proves the point that a lot of basketball fans and a lot of non-basketball fans say is that the real NBA season starts with the playoffs. Forget everything else.
It's almost as, we were talking about this earlier. It's almost as if they play way too much basketball at this time in the season. And why don't they shorten the season or make the playoff game shorter? Back in the day, they used to have five games in the first round.
Right, and I think they should go back to that. And hockey's got the same problem. Even though there's some exciting hockey games going on, it's still, you know, we're centuries away from the Stanley Cup.
It's emotionally, spiritually in exhausting. If you're really committed to watching all these games, if you're really committed to all these teams, you're going to be sitting in front of your TV a lot.
And I guess you had a little problem with your television access in the middle of that Game 7.
So, yeah, so I ended up watching it at a grimy sports bar in Albany, which was a unique experience for me, and I'm usually not in those settings, but it was definitely fun because you got all these screens around you.
And there are some grimy sports bars in Albany. Let's talk about the Celtics for a moment. When those Celtics starters come back on the court, there's a real sense that there's power there. There's a real sense that the Celtics definitely have a team that can put it together. What explains why this went to Game 7?
Well, first of all, the Celtics are depleted. They're without their main guy, Kevin Garnett, and they're without one of their best guys, Leon Poe. Leon Poe led, when he was at Cal, he led the Pac-10 in scoring. They were a depleted Celtics team, but they still had a new big three with Rondo, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen.
But Garnett, just his presence on the court has an emotional impact on the team.
I think Garnett is whispering into every player, but really at the end of each game, you see Paul Pierce. Paul Pierce, every time, at the end of every game, every close game, he's talking to every single player. He's talking to people in the huddle. He's the real leader of the team.
But this NBA playoffs is all about, can LeBron make it all the way, right?
Everyone wants to see LeBron versus Kobe. LeBron versus Kobe. You forget that the Bulls had what he was talking about, Vinny Del Negro, that small lineup. He's talking about Derrick Rose, Ben Gordon, John Salmons, and Kirk Heinrich. They brought in players in the middle of the season. They had a losing record in the beginning of the season. They brought in players at the second half of the season, and they made a run that's spectacular.
So who does Cleveland have to get by to advance?
Right now, Cleveland is playing Atlanta, and I'm calling this the most athletic series in the next round. That if you want to see just pure, straight-up athleticism, watch that series.
Of course, we've been talking about the East, and nobody pays attention to the East in the NBA. It's all about the West, and as you say, Kobe. What are those matchups looking like?
I'm excited about the LA-Houston matchup. You got Ron Artest, who was the much-maligned player for the Pacers that got involved in that big brawl a couple years back. He is, I think, probably the only guy that can guard Kobe and LeBron. So right now you have them. Him and Yao Ming and a bunch of other cast of characters going against the Lakers. I mean, I would love to predict an upset. It's not going to happen.
What matchups are going to bring the NBA back? Certainly, it's struggled in the last couple of years in terms of ratings and profile. TV contracts are a problem. What are the matchups they're going to say, NBA, you're a bankable asset?
Well, William Roden of the New York Times columnist just called this game, this Celtics-Boston series, the best series ever in basketball history. That's a big claim, but also Mike in the Morning, they call it the best series ever in NBA history. I think that series brought it back.
But if they don't go up from here, then it's a disaster.
It's a very good point. The Dallas-Denver series, LA and Houston, this season, this playoffs is really, really tight. Actually, the under-the-radar one, Orlando versus Boston, might be the most boring, but it might be the most competitive.
A point on hockey for a moment. The Canadians dominate typically, and the goalies dominate most of all. What style of hockey are you seeing? I mean, this is a really high-profile playoff post the disaster that the NHL went through 2-3 years ago.
What you have right now is you have Pittsburgh, Sidney Crosby, and Washington's Alex Ovechkin. They're the last two players to capture the Hart Trophy as the league MVP. And then you have also Crosby's teammate Evgeny Malkin. They literally, the youngest, brightest, fastest, most artistic hockey players in the NHL are playing against each other.
No thuggery. It's all artistry at this point.
Indeed.
All right. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports blogger, takeaway contributor, racking it all up on a Monday morning as we figure out what happened over the weekend. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Thank you.
Is there any sport to headlines from Femi Okay?
I haven't sport.
You're a good sport.
He sucked it all up. I have nothing left for you, but I do have other news. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. H1N1, or swine flu, is creating diplomatic tension between Mexico and Japan. Chinese officials have quarantined dozens of Mexican visitors, including many apparently not at risk. Many on lockdown haven't shown symptoms or been in touch with infected people. Mexico's president, Felipe Calderon, says that China is unfairly targeting Mexicans.
It seems unfair to me that after we were honest and transparent with the world, some countries or places are taking discriminatory measures because of ignorance and misinformation. Because the truth is, they are discriminatory against Mexicans.
Now, China.
Why is the tension with Japan?
Excuse me?
You said the tension between Mexico and Japan.
I'm sorry, I meant Mexico and China. Okay. Apologies there. Thank you for picking that up.
I just didn't, the Japanese were calling.
Yes, no, sorry about that. So China denies signaling out Mexicans, and it says it's doing only what's needed for safety. And China has a reputation for tough and bold action on diseases going back to SARS earlier on this decade. And Mexico is chartering a plane to bring its citizens home from China. Let's look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Dr. Peter Ben Mbarek, World Health Organization food safety scientist, had this to say.
This is not a foodborne disease. You don't get this disease through eating pork. And therefore, there is no reason to be afraid of consuming pork or pork products.
He said that over the weekend, but it hasn't stopped people from changing their eating habits to the point that Mike Faga, who's Human Resources Director at Iowa Select Farms, has had to adjust a little bit. Mike joins us now. Thanks for being part of the program, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you.
I suspect most of your day is concerned with the actual human resources at Iowa Select Farms, but last week did you have to focus your efforts maybe more on the actual pigs at Iowa Select Farms and explaining to people what's going on?
Yeah, we really did. We still kept our focus on the people because this is a human disease, but just educating them and getting them the facts so they can share those facts with their families and their neighbors and really that I guess reiterating to them that there is no risk at this point to them from having contact with pigs and coming to work every day.
Now, do you think that it was inappropriate for the media to focus on swine flu and that maybe the nomenclature used by the World Health Organization, H1N1, is more appropriate and would have, helped you out a little bit last week?
Well, I think it would have, but I think at the time when it was released, it was a little bit unfortunate, but yet no one knew for sure. You know, it had commonly been referred to as the swine flu over the years, and I don't know that anybody thought it would have this kind of negative impact on the pig industry, so...
What sort of impact has it had on your company specifically?
Well,
financially speaking.
Yeah, the markets have definitely been affected by it. And we have most of our products contracted, so we are okay there. But just the overall cash market and the effect that has on a longer term and affecting the futures market will definitely impact us financially, and hopefully we can rebound from this.
Now, of course, flu is a part of everyone's reality everywhere in the world every year. When flu season begins, you're offered a chance to get a flu shot, and there's a discussion of what's the DNA this time around, and always maybe some sort of suspicion that somewhere in the background there's the 1918 scenario, which, of course, was devastating to the world. That hasn't repeated itself. But what do you do routinely there at Iowa Select Farms to deal with flu? I mean, it is swine flu. Do you do something every year?
Exactly. Yes. Every year we offer flu shots to all of our employees at no charge. That's something the company does. And we're really concerned just about a human health, again, the health and well-being of our employees. So we offer that service at the beginning of flu season.
But are you required to check the pigs and to make sure what's going on there, keeps flu from breaking out?
We have groups of experts that visit our farms on a weekly basis and are monitoring for not only the flu but any kind of health challenges that they may face and the care and well-being of the pigs.
It's a double challenge, monitoring pigs and humans. Human Resource Director at Iowa Select Farms, Mike Faga, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farah Jadea. We've got Femi okay with the headlines. I was particularly upset that one of my favorite shopping venues was closing, but I'm sure you have more serious news.
Farah, I'm almost speechless. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Almost, but not quite. I didn't put that in the news. I'm so sorry. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Two unions representing some Boston Globe workers announced this morning that they've reached agreements with the newspaper's owner, our partner, the New York Times Company. However, negotiations with the largest union continued through a midnight deadline and will start up again later this week. The Times says that it's prepared to file a 60-day shutdown notice if the union doesn't agree to concessions. China is responding speedily to tackle the cases of the H1N1 or swine flu that they've detected there. So when a guest at a Hong Kong hotel became ill with swine flu, medical staff and police banned the guests from leaving. Eddie Sweeney and his wife have been stuck in their hotel room all weekend.
When we got to the door, we were barred by police and people in white coats and masks and all sorts of gear on. So the hotel has effectively been locked down until Friday the 8th.
Sweeney and more than 300 guests at the Metro Park Hotel in Hong Kong are only allowed to leave their hotel rooms to collect meals. American journalist Roxana Saberi was briefly in an Iranian hospital after she refused to drink water. She's been on hunger strike for the last 2 weeks to protest her 8-year prison sentence. Saberi was convicted on charges of espionage after a one-day trial in Iran. The U.S. government has called the charges baseless. Saberi was later released from the hospital after drinking water. Just left a little bit of time for Farai's story. Your story is what, Farai?
Well, you know, it's about the fashion, you know. It's Filene's. Filene's was where I, as a college student, I used to get all my cheap stuff. And, you know, I know it's not a must, but there's some interesting stories about things that you don't have to buy that are still critically important. You know, one of them is the prom. People ask, do you have a date, a tux, a gown, a limo? How about the corsage? What about the photos? Are you going to buy the photos? We all know the photos are ridiculously expensive. At the end of everything, going to the prom can cost some teens hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. The parents usually shell out the cash, but they're not cutting back. Christine Hawney, a reporter for the New York Times, recently investigated this question. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
So what made you look at something this specific economically?
I was actually working on a story on foreclosure, and I found when I was with a family who was facing foreclosure that a lot of the discussion revolved around prom. And even though they were fighting keeping their home, they were still making sure that their daughter made it to her junior prom. And we're not talking about wearing a, you know, an inexpensive gown. She was still wearing a $425 gown, still getting the party bus, still getting the hair, the nails, everything done. So that made me start looking at it as a sociological question. Why are people spending so much money on prom when we're in one of the worst economies in recent decades?
And you actually went and looked at states where foreclosure rates were up, right?
Yes. I found that the prom industry is actually booming in parts of Florida. If you look at parts of California near Orange County where the mortgage industry was concentrated, they still have people buying very expensive gowns. I spoke with a dress shop owner just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, where so many banks are concentrated. Still business is up and still people are doing whatever they can to go to prom.
Yeah, and we actually spoke to one of those shop owners in California, and this is Suzanne Aguila, who's been in the business of selling prom dresses for over 20 years.
I don't know where all these kids are coming from, but I'm getting customers that are driving from Orange County, Bakersfield, and I've never seen anything like this. To me, this is a little strange, and I was not ready for this at all. And I think what's happening is the family members are helping to pitch in to buy that girl her $300 or $400 or $500 prom dress. And that's the difference that I see now.
$300, $400 prom dress. I know a friend of mine who bought her wedding dress for $125 in a secondhand store. I mean,
she's still married?
She is, very happily.
Yeah, to
I mean, what's the deal? Is this the real price for gowns these days?
Yes, and actually, in some cases, when I spoke with one dress shop owner in Florida, she said people were spending $800-$900 in the last couple of years, and that was in southern Florida. Those people have now dropped to the $500 price range. So there's a tremendous amount of money being poured into this one night, and for a gown that's typically worn just once.
Wow. Well, you interviewed quite a few people, and we are talking to, got a little bit of sound from someone who you interviewed, Michelle from Passaic Valley Regional High in Little Falls, New Jersey.
Well, we're all meeting up at a friend of mine's house to take pictures, and we're taking a limo to the restaurant, and it's at the Crystal Plaza, and my parents are helping me pay for it. They haven't told me that I had to, but I want to help them. It's the last time that all of us are going to be together as a class. So, like, it's probably one of the last times that we're going to see each other and get to have fun together.
Wow. It's kind of like a rite of passage for the child, but it's also about the parents a lot, it seems.
It seems to be very much about the parents as well, that they want their child to have this. And a lot of parents were sacrificing a lot to get their kids to prom. Quite a few parents I spoke to were giving up buying clothes, shoes, going out to dinner. They were really thinking about a lot of their budgets to make sure that their child went to prom.
Now, one of the things that really fascinates me about this is if you think about people who could lose their home, why do you think it's so important? Is it a matter of pride? Like, we're not going to let our kid be the one kid who doesn't show up at prom or who shows up with a ugly dress? Or what do you think the motivation is when they, frankly, many people would say, well, why don't you just try to save your house?
Well, one of the things we're finding is that parents will kind of cut anything except these rites of passage and things for their kids, whether it's prom, whether it's violin lessons, they'll forgo anything. But there's also, I guess this had happened during the late Great Depression, that people would do whatever they could, and that's a time when the prom actually took off even more as well, because there's a tremendous compulsion to keep up with appearances, and families will do whatever they can to keep that going, no matter what the financial situation is.
All right, we do have a a father who is actually this is a high school senior from New Jersey, yet another teen who's making some sacrifices, Corey Rockauer, and who's seen some kids struggle to find a way, but his father is actually footing the bill.
I'm very lucky that my dad is able to pay for something like that, because a lot of kids, at first really balked at this, but, kids are finding a way to be able to do it.
Just very quickly, what do you think we should take away from this?
That people are going to spend on these rites of passage no matter what their financial situation is, and that hopefully with this recession, people will realize that it is okay to be a little more thrifty than it was during other economic downturns.
All right. Thanks so much, Christine Hawney of the New York Times.
An economic indicator. Proms not necessarily going south, even though concerns about them are. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
So we mentioned it already this hour, but my co-host, Adora Udoji, who we began this program with, is leaving The Takeaway to spend more time with her new daughter, we've been telling you about for the last several weeks, and she wanted to say farewell to all of you.
Good morning. This is Adora Udoji, joining you to say a heartfelt goodbye because I'm leaving The Takeaway. It's been an amazing year, and I cannot thank you, the listeners, enough for your dedication and participation in this one-of-a-kind show. It's also been an extraordinary learning experience. I want you to know that behind the scenes, you have some brilliant minds and some of the hardest-working people I have ever seen. From the control room to the associate producers to our assistant, they work really hard, and it's been a pleasure to be a part of it all. My husband, Ron Allen, who's a correspondent at NBC News, and I, as many of you know, have just adopted a baby girl. And as many of you know, children change your life, and mine has changed. I'm proud of what The Takeaway has accomplished, and I'm honored to have worked with such a talented group of people on the show. Journalism will always be my passion, and I look forward to returning to my career at some point in the future. For now, I wish you all the best.
And we wish you the best, Adora Udoji. Good luck. And so we're asking what a recession-proof purchase is in your house. Through this economy, you've been scrimping and saving, but are there some pleasures still worth it? For several of you, it's spending on your children.
My name is Annie, and I'm calling from Connecticut. What I will not give up, no matter what the recession is about, is my therapy. It's about parenting, and I've done therapy about being pregnant and having a new child and now adopting, and I wouldn't give it up.
And Sandy writes on our site, I won't drink cheap beer. I would still rather spend a little extra for the good stuff.
Rusty Deaton from Detroit, Michigan. I find that the most recession-proof item in my budget is energy drinks, and that's because, they keep me aware at work. And if I weren't aware at work, I'd lose my job, so I guess they aren't too recession-proof after all.
My name is Natalie, and I will not give up my Tango Socials. I go to them almost every night, and I will not give them up.
Tango Socials, but you can't top this. Mark in Detroit emails us, season tickets for the Lions. It's a tough decision year after year because they are so bad, but I still can't give them up. That's what Mark writes. Tell us what's recession-proof in your budget on our site, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.